Hello, everybody. My name is Seth Bosted, and I'm a composer. I'm also the executive director of Access Contemporary Music, and we do a ton of programs to foster the creation of new music at all levels and bring it to new audiences. One of our programs is called Relevant Tones, and it is the country's only, as far as I know, weekly podcast about contemporary classical music. So tonight is a relatively complicated event because it's a live taping of the Relevant Tones podcast. But for these live tapings, we like to have a theme. And tonight, our theme is the evolution of language. And on the stage with me right now is Todd Lippe, who runs the Esopus Foundation. And they are a co-producer.
Thank you.
With Access Contemporary Music of the Relevant Tones Live series. That's where you're at, Relevant Tones Live, here at Symphony Space. And if you'll please, because our theme tonight is the evolution of language, Todd and I were thinking, should we get a linguist? Yeah. So we did. So please put your hands together for John McWhorter. John has written 22 books. 24 books. He wrote two backstage. He's written 24 books. He hosts a podcast, at least one, right? I mean, writes for the New York Times. He's a professor at Columbia University. It's incredible you even have the time to be here.
Right. With I'm not all alive. That.
Thank you very much. So we're going to talk with John, Todd and I about language, about the evolution of language, about music. And we have four pieces tonight, three of which were commissioned by Access Contemporary Music. We picked, again, John has a lot of books, but we picked a book called The Power of Babel, which we'll be talking about. And we kind of modeled the evening on that. So we'll hear all four of the pieces. Three were commissioned by ACM. One was a pre-existing piece that deals with language as well, and all of the composers are here, which is really cool. So we will hear them talk about their pieces. So let's jump in. Let's talk about language a little bit here. There's so much to talk about. This is a vast subject. So I'm just going to kick it off by saying, you know, for me personally, one of the things I used to love 20 some odd years ago was going to Europe and just making a complete fool out of myself, you know, because nobody really spoke English in those days. And you had to, I mean, you're doing a lot of pointing and meet hungry and, you know, and I feel like there's less and less of that. Like people are speaking English more and more when I go. And it feels like the language world is maybe shrinking. I mean, is that true? Is that this is just in my lifetime what I'm seeing. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's partly the instant translation technology, which means that, unfortunately, you don't really, I don't know if it's unfortunately or fortunately, but you don't really need to be able to halfway say, I'm hungry when you go somewhere, because you can either use a device, or more and more people speak English, or some kind of English, and so it isn't as necessary as it used to be. So those old language textbooks where you're in Germany and you have to know German to get a hotel room, that's completely gone at this point.
Well, that was always fun, too, because you'd be like, Haben Sie ein Zimmer, you know, and which
I
memorized.
That.
Yeah. And then they come back with some, you know,
you're
like,
No,
I'm done.
Like,
no. Yes or no.
Even then, he spoke English. Yeah.
I know, exactly. So, I mean, you know, it seems to me like, I mean, there was one language in the beginning, or you know, in Power of Babel, you talk about an Ur language from which the 6,000 or 7,000 languages developed. Are we now shrinking back down to an Ur language?
You're making me remember that book, which I think was 2002. I did say that. There's some people who say that language would have emerged in several different places. I'm inclined to disagree. I'm almost sure that it was once. And back then, I was saying 6,000 languages. I was told a few years after that it's better to say 7,000. So I learned
to say
that.
These are distinct languages, as opposed to like dialects or...
Where do you draw the line on that? My sense is that it's really 6,000 languages, but if you want to make it sound more fecund than 7,000, and maybe there were more than that in the distant past, and we're at the point where probably... In about 100 years, there'll be maybe 700, 800 languages that are actually being passed on to children. Luckily, the ones that we still have now are being documented. Some of them can be kept on a kind of life support as taught languages. I remember putting it that way in Babel. So the way Irish survives in a lot of Ireland, the way probably everybody in this room speaks Spanish, you know, a lot of languages will be like that. And so that is happening, but yes, and the international language, for better or for worse, is the one that we're speaking right here. English is a monster language. There are a few of those, but English is the monster of monsters.
Why is English so successful as a language? I mean, you know, it was French at one time, you know, the lingua franca, right? Why English now? I mean, is it just because the United States is such a large country and so culturally dominant?
It's partly how large the United States became and how dominant it became, especially after about 1900. and the fact that that involved English happening to get in the door first in terms of media and communications technology, so that it's hard to go back to the way things were. But yes, French used to be the language of diplomacy. That changed to English as France and the UK changed places in terms of their dominance of the geopolitical scene. But that means that English has taken its place in terms of, you know, how airplanes are run, what most of the internet is, and it's hard to reverse that. It doesn't hurt that as languages go, you have harder languages to learn than English. And I don't mean that the spelling system is a mess, but that's just the surface. The grammar, you can approximate English. You can say, do you have a hotel room, and get it relatively right. If we're speaking Navajo, to say, do you have a hotel room, would be like learning calculus. You know, many languages are much, much harder than English. But really, it's just that English got there first. We could be all speaking Russian, but we're not.
What is the most difficult language to learn or speak? Mandarin? Or?
There's no one, but some languages are so hard you can't imagine a human being speaking them without having a stroke. And actually, I was talking to one of our other Columbia linguists today, William Foley, about what are, I just heard a laugh out there, which must be
is the Professor Foley here?
I heard that sound, you guys. We were talking about what is the hardest language in the world, and actually we said Navajo and its relatives are absurd, but then he knows, not in a bad way, but just in terms of how difficult they are, then he knows of some languages in New Guinea that I don't think are real in terms of all of the irregularity, difficult pronunciation, but really the hardest that I know of in terms of I really wonder whether they got this right. There's a language spoken by about negative 17 people in a swamp in Siberia called Ket. And Ket is so hard that even the experts haven't fully figured out the rules yet. They're still trying to work out what the system is. And you start to think there really isn't one. I mean, it's just frighteningly difficult. It's wonderful just reading through a grammatical description. Yes, sometimes I do that for fun. And thinking, how in the world did this happen? And it has a dead relative named Yo. It's really Yo, which was even harder. So the swamp language.
What makes a language hard? I you know, just because, I mean, there's only so many, I mean, it's the present tense, it's the past tense. I mean, aren't there only so many ways that you can construct? No, okay. No. Non-linguist here, folks.
It's okay. You know how we have child and children?
Yeah.
Imagine a language where all nouns were like that, where you just kind of have to know what the plural is. Or in terms of verbs, we say walk, walks. Well, you know in Spanish, it's going to be hablo, hablas, habla, hablamos, cucu, hablan. Right. And so you have to know all of that. Imagine if there were many, many more things that you had to know in terms of not just the past and the future. Many languages have the recent future, the yesterday future, a week ago, long, long ago, wow. All with different endings. And then other languages do that with the past, and some of them do it on both sides. There's so much. English is a naked little language in many ways, as complicated as we think of it as being. So yeah, languages go places.
Is it, sorry.
No, please.
Is it, does gender make a language more complicated?
Mm-hmm. Because it's often arbitrary. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing if it's, what is a male pig? Male pig, and then sow. That's fine. But when you're talking about what gender is an umbrella, well, that's just going to be whatever, and you just kind of have to know.
Right.
And if you speak it natively, you don't think about it. But if you have to learn it, well, that is it's a burden.
Right.
English is the only Indo-European, i.e. the big family that English belongs to. It's the only Indo-European language in Europe that doesn't have gender. So we think, oh, isn't it fancy that Spanish and German and Russian have gender? No, we're impoverished in not having it. It's very normal, but it makes the language harder in that way. Yeah,
that's very interesting. When you study language, you're also studying a culture. Why would a culture need, you know, to pluralize these things? Why would a culture need such a difficult language? I mean, does that make sense as a question? Like, how would they develop in that way?
It's so hard to feel this because we know our lives and we know our language. Any language vastly overshoots what you need to express humanity. So I've been told that this sounds dismissive. I don't mean it this way, but there's no reason for a hat to be a boy. El sombrero, la luna. It's just there. It used to make sense when the sun really was thought of as having male qualities 400 billion years ago. But then it just drags this along because kids can learn almost anything, and by the time you realize it's hard, you're stuck. You've already learned it. That's true of so much of what a language is. It keeps growing and growing. In Babel, I used a cat. I said that a cat is curious and always going into little places. And that was actually only true of the cat I had then. The cat I have now is one of the least curious beings in the whole world. But Laura the cat used to always go into places. That's what languages do. So you get the gender. You get the subjunctive. What is that? You don't need that.
I hated that when I found that in Spanish.
Yeah, it's like,
I was cruising
it.
Along until right. subjunctive.
Vaya. Yeah, well, many languages have that sort of thing. So yeah, it's not that a language needs to be complicated. It's that it can be. And if nobody gets in its way, it becomes complicated.
That was my next question. Yeah, if a culture is isolated from other influences, does the language tend to become more complicated?
Yeah. I mean, for example, in a swamp,
right.
literally nobody wants to go where the cat are. That is a lot of why that language is that way. If the language gets around, it gets beaten up, and it's more likely to be a language like English. Now, school can hold that back. There is no English like Russian, and Russian Slavic languages are really, really tough. Mm. But that's because of education. If it's just people running around talking, which is most of human history, then the ones that get around are always more user-friendly, almost always. Mm.
Let's hear our first piece of music. So I'm going to welcome to the stage Noah Kay here, who is the composer and will also be playing soprano saxophone. And Rosie Kay will be working with the laptop there. And Todd, I'm going to let Noah use your mic if I could, because he's going to stand right there. Well, can you actually pull it off of the, if it's not too difficult? Because then Noah can stand where the video can see him and tell us about his piece and how it relates to the book.
Hi, so Rosie and my piece is called Babel, kind of an obvious title, but it was a very inspiring idea to make music and words to. The music was sort of, we were thinking about the music in terms of these component parts. We were thinking a lot about John's ideas about language constantly evolving and transforming. And in this piece, you hear these long notes, arpeggios, sort of simple, basic components of music that each player plays, and they combine and recombine in different ways in different contexts, which changes the meaning of them throughout the piece. And the voice, there's this disembodied voice that is a non-human voice that's in the process of learning language, in this case, mostly English with some German at the end. And this disembodied voice begins with consonants and vowels, sort of evolves to speak words, and finally speaks in these looping phrases, all taken from John's book.
All right, great.
Yeah, I was very inspired by the examples that John used throughout. So all of those words.
This is exciting.
I know, I want to write a book so somebody can make music out of it. This is cool. Thank you.
Mein Leben ist eine Giving Story. Ich habe verstanden, dass man contemporary sein muss, das Future-Denking haben muss. Mein Leben ist eine Giving Story. Ich habe verstanden, dass man contemporary sein muss, das Future-Denking haben muss, eine Giving Story. Ich habe verstanden, dass man contemporary sein muss, das Future-Denking haben muss. Ich habe verstanden, dass man contemporary sein muss. Das ich habe verstanden, das habe verstanden, das habe verstanden, das habe verstanden, das standen, das standen, das habe verstanden, das habe verstanden, das habe verstanden, das Future-Denks, Future-Denken haben, das Future-Denken, das Future-Denken, das Future-Denken, das Future-Denken haben muss, das Future-Denken haben muss, das Future-Denken haben muss, das Future-Denken haben, das Future-Denken haben, das Future-Denken haben, das Future-Denken haben, das Future-Denken haben. Das
All right, that's Babel by Noah and Rosie Kay, who also performed, sitting in with our band for the evening. So let me introduce our band for the evening. We have Jay Source on electric guitar. Eva Kasian-Lakos on cello, and Suleiman Tekali on violin. They'll be here with us all night, playing the pieces. Yeah, how was that? How was that experience?
That was a beautiful piece of work. It wasn't what I was thinking when I wrote Babel a while ago, however I wish I had been, and it kept me going the whole time. I like the abrupt changes in particular.
That's, you know, for us musicians, as composers, we write a piece of music, we put it out there, and, you know, when we're gone or not at the concert or not at the rehearsal, we don't know how they're going to interpret it. I mean, you know, and it's kind of the same for an author, right? I mean, now somebody's given this artistic interpretation of your book, and, you know, you wrote that book a long time ago. It's, you know, it's a child that's grown up that's on its own now, kind of doing its own things, right?
My books are, I've often called them my children until I had children of my own, and you work on them, you craft them, you put them out into the world, you worry that they're going to be misinterpreted, you're happy if they aren't, you're happy if they inspire something after a while, but yeah, they are your kids. It's something that you craft and that you care about. You don't just crank them out, or I don't. My favorite thing is writing books as opposed to all the other things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, his students are in the audience. He loves you guys. Don't. You're the second favorite.
Of course.
Yes. And there's so much musicality to language, obviously, needless to say, I mean, which I think is very interesting. And I was thinking, you know, I mean, I'm so fascinated with this idea of an Ur language, and you were talking about language developing maybe in one place, which I do want to return to. But, I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, you watch a baby and it's vocalizing, and I think it's just for sheer pleasure of hearing its own voice, which is basically music, making noise for pleasure, you know, or pain, is music. I mean,
There's a relationship, yeah. There are no humans that don't have music. Right. There are no humans that don't have language, and there's obviously a nexus between the two. Some people, one fashionable theory about how language started is that maybe it started as something sung, and then gradually became what we know as music, as language, with the remnant of the musicality being that we have intonation, or maybe even in some languages, tones. So people say that. I don't know if I go for it, but I wouldn't rule it completely out. But certainly language and music are complementary skills in many ways.
Could I have a strange question to ask you? Could you liken a certain genre of music with a certain type of language? Like if, you know, Navajo, what would be the, you know...
It's like the blues or something. Is that
what
you're doing?
I was thinking more like, you know, Stockhausen. Or, I don't know. I know you say Malay is a very sort of, not simple language, but a relatively straightforward language. Is that, but it's not tonal, I think?
I've never
minimalism? Like, I don't know. Is there some way to...
I know what they taste like, but I've never thought about how they sound. Navajo is Stockhausen. Malay would be Calypso.
Ooh, nice.
Russian is Tchaikovsky. That's what Russian is. French is Zeva. French is early jazz.
Mm-hmm.
That's French.
Edith Piaf walking into the background.
Right. And Mandarin. What kind of music is it?
12-tone.
It is a tonal language, though. I mean,
no, but it's the way it actually sounds. It's like somebody's on the train and they're saying, "Doya, what music is that?" That is, I feel bad saying it, but it's the music that you might play if it's like the soundtrack of Lawrence of Arabia.
Uh-huh.
It's that kind of music that's about dunes and wide skies. That's Mandarin. Yeah. I'm making this up.
I love it. That's fantastic. On the subject of music and language, why are some languages tonal and others not? Is there a reason for that?
The reason is dull, and I'm gonna try to make it better. Because what we want to say is because they are musical people or something like that. But that's not it. And then there are also theories that it's more likely where it's hot. That might be true, but that doesn't really help. What happens is this: if I say "bap," and if I say "bab," chances are when I say "bap," the "a" is going to be a little higher than if I say "bab." "P" and "b" are variations on the same thing. "Bap," "bab." Things are always dropping off of the end of words. So suppose after a while people are saying "bap" and "bap." Well, then you've got tones, because then that's the only way you can tell that they're different. That's the way it often happens, so it's just kind of an accident. And then after a while, if a language next door is tonal, the one next door might become tonal too if there's bilingualism between the two. But really, it just starts because consonants fade either at the end, or it can also happen at the beginning of a word, and it just leaves behind. It's like the Cheshire Cat smile. I think I use that in Babel. And so, when it used to be that you wouldn't even have noticed that because you're thinking of the bap and the bab. That's how tone happens. So see how that's not interesting, but it is in a way, because something that is so prominent in Mandarin happened because of that a very long time ago.
And maybe that culture didn't develop a tonal language because they're inherently musical, but people who speak tonal languages have a higher incidence of perfect pitch, for
example. It's been proven, yeah. Once you have a tonal language, it does predispose you.
Okay, because you're hearing the different levels of tones naturally.
In the womb. Time.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So you have that ability.
Yeah, oh, that's pretty cool. Noah mentioned it, but in The Power of Babel, you talk about language being, evolving the way that physical beings do. And I'm very interested in that idea, the evolution, I mean, really, the life cycle of language. I mean, it very much evolves. There's a Darwinianism that can be applied to language. Is that a good way to put it?
Kind of, and I'm squinting because, honestly, I don't pick up my children. I don't go read my books much once they're
gone. I
love
putting you on the spot here. this book you wrote 20-some-odd years ago.
No, that one, the pages are yellow. But I think what I meant by the evolution is not that one language is fitter than another, but that generally you start out with a language, and a language can start out as being a whole bunch of words, say, for example, a pigeon, if somebody has to learn Polish very quickly and never really does. Suppose you have to keep using the pigeon. Well, then the words come together, they start to create grammar with one another, and you've got a language. Then I think chapter 3 is titled something like languages get more complicated than they have to. So after a while, you start getting things like the subjunctive and meaningless gender, and it can go as far as ket. It usually doesn't. And then in that book, I have it that languages start coming together, and so they start mixing their features, and that can actually make languages more complicated. And then, I remember in a book, you have to keep the string taut. You want to keep the reader going. And I remember thinking with that one, how do I make it an arc? And the way I did it was then I say that some languages go extinct. And so you have all of this complexity, you have all this mixture, but then sometimes the language then dies. And what do you do if you see the language dying? You try to record it, etc. But that was the life cycle that I gave. And the idea was not to show that languages evolve in order to be fitter than other languages, but there is an evolutionary aspect to how languages work. And they always change, I remember the other chapter, they always change over time. And so new things are always coming in as other things are going out. The language at point A is going to be a different language at point B, no matter what you do. It's just a matter of how fast or how slowly that's going to happen.
When a language is going extinct, are there efforts made, as there are with species that are about to go extinct, and how does that work? Is that, do you enlist people to learn it and to...
It happens a lot today, because most of the world's languages, you could say, or half, are endangered in some way. So the idea is to, if it's gone, if nobody is speaking it at all, you can try to resurrect it from the page if enough of it was transcribed that you can do it. And that's being done, actually, there are some languages in Australia where they're actually taking old word lists and dictionaries, and somebody with a mustache and three names wrote a grammatical description 150 years ago, taking that and then getting it back into people's mouths. And what comes out is quite different from what it was before, but is a whole lot better than nothing. Or let's say that everybody who speaks the language is 75. Even if they're speaking it fluently, if the people who are 50 aren't, there's a problem, because the way you really learn a language is to be listening to it literally in the womb, and certainly throughout childhood. And so there are many efforts to teach people their ancestral languages. Many groups want to have some kind of contact with their ancestral language. It's an exception that they don't. And so it's happening in many cases, but it's hard, because learning languages is hard, as probably all of us have experienced after about the age of really 2. Learning a language is difficult if we're talking about books and blackboards, or even today, Duolingo. How do you learn thousands of words? Mm. How do you learn a grammar that doesn't taste right to you, because that's not how your language does it? And then more to the point, how do you learn all of the idioms, which is really all a language is? And so, for example, I might say, Timothy, what are you doing there? Now, I'm looking at Timothy. I know exactly what he's doing. Mm. That's the way we say, why are you there? That's an idiom. That's something none of us have probably ever thought about. All languages are like that. So you have to know thousands of those. That's tough to do with Duolingo, or even the ones that are better, which is all of the learning methods are better than that. And so there are these efforts being made. And funny, with William Foley today, we were saying, in all of these cases, when the language is reborn and people are learning it when they're 40, it's not going to be anything like what it was, but maybe that's good enough. Yeah. But that's happening with a lot of languages today.
I always think of ballet, you know, Balanchine teaching dancers by dancing with them, and then the dancers teaching the next generation of dancers. Like, there's not a...
And it gets thinner as the signal gets passed down. That's a very good analogy. Yeah. People who dance with him, and now it's... Right. Yeah,
three steps removed from
it. Yeah, as a composer, I find that horrifying, that choreographers don't write it down.
There's no agreed-upon method. Yeah, it's hard.
I'm just going to show people... First of all, I don't play the violin, so I can't show Sully how to, you know. But secondly, like, yeah, the notation is the point.
And nobody filmed these things often. Yeah, it's hard.
With preservation of language, though, I'm thinking, you know, I mean, the vocabulary itself, I mean, you know, table versus tish versus mesa, whatever. I mean, you know, we can lexicograph all of these words, you know, who cares? But the grammatical concepts is what's interesting, right? I mean, a culture, that tells you about the culture, whether the language is gendered, whether how many tenses it has. I mean, it seems like that's worth preserving, because you're seeing, you know, you're preserving this culture kind of through their language in amber. I mean, is there, that I would be much more interested in knowing, not knowing the person's, you know, this culture's language, but saying this is the culture X number of years ago in this place, and these were their grammatical concepts.
You know, Seth, I wish that what you were saying were truer than it is. There's another one of my children, and it's called The Language Hoax, and it's about the idea that your language channels the way you think. There's some evidence of it, and so, for example, Russian doesn't have a word for blue. It has a word for light blue, and it has a word for dark blue. Those are both single words. There's no way to just say blue. They are a tiny bit more sensitive to the gradation between dark and light blue than we are. But in terms of, say, this language doesn't really have a future tense, and so it's just done by context, that doesn't tell you that that is a culture where people don't think about the future as much, or there's actually a theory that it makes you think about the future more. The correlations are very difficult to find. And so if you find a language that, say, a missionary took down, and you look at the things that it has and the things that it doesn't have, usually you're not going to find that much about them as souls through the way the grammar worked. You'll find it for what they had words for and things like that. But the grammar itself tends to do its own thing and to go its own way. So, for example, imagine if we didn't know what the subjunctive was. And then there's this missionary with the three names, and he's describing some language, and they have a subjunctive. We might think, well, that means that they were more sensitive to the counterfactual and the hypothetical. Mm-hmm. But we know that Italians and Spaniards and French people, they are not especially sensitive to the hypothetical. It's just that they've got that damned subjunctive. No offense. And so it's one of those things where you want it to be true. I remember I was taught that in an anthropology class by this very sad man. But the truth is it doesn't work as well as you might think. I wish it did.
I almost studied anthropology, and it was another sad man who got me into music. But anyway, I'm sure there are plenty of non-sad anthropologists out there.
Probably the same guy.
Could be. This is a great place for a music break. Let's bring up the composer, Will Rowe, to talk about the piece that he wrote for our ensemble here and tell us how it relates to our theme of the day. Will, you out there?
Yeah.
All right. Good. Because if he left, that would be really awkward. Very awkward.
Thanks, Todd. All right. Thanks, guys. My piece is called Hydra's Guide to Parenthood. And analogy in The Power of Babel used to describe language is the lava lamp. But you know, that's the Mars reading.
Oh yeah, that's
yeah. Yeah, the way it changes. And but you know, eventually I started to conceive of it kind of more as a 7,000-headed hydra here, each with its own distinct beings and personalities. You know, different relationships with each other and how they come into being. And that is where the title comes from. And the piece itself is a theme and variations, and they explore these five ways that that John details in the first chapter of the book, on specifically how language changes. You know, it changes itself over time, changes into others over time, and those would be the combination and truncations of sounds, kind of remix of grammar here. The title of that section is "Grammar Gets a Virus."
This is going to be in the music.
Yes.
Yeah, and it'll be
this
a quiz.
This is very exciting.
This is your life.
Yeah. Yeah. The third is the gradual decay of expressiveness and weight of a word or phrase given exposure. The fourth is rebracketing of sounds into recreation and recontextualization of these things, and the last being simply semantic change. The same word being given new meaning just as it evolves over time.
Oh yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, this is good.
Good job, Will. You took the assignment to heart. I told all the composers, I'm going to ask you on stage how it relates to language. So, all right, let's do it. Thank you. Will Rose.
Bravo. You guys in the band, you were fantastic.
I know. Oh, they're extraordinary. Another, yeah, please. They're extraordinary.
That was so good.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of the most queerly delicious things I've heard in months.
Oh, and well, I don't mean, well, you I mean put queer. That in your, yeah. That's a great quote.
Keep
queerly delicious.
That was fantastic.
That's a nice book title.
You know what that sounded, maybe it is actually. Mm. That sounded like what life is to me.
Wow,
you know?
Another great quote.
That's life.
I love that every instrument sounded like it was speaking to me.
They were talking.
They were talking. It was a conversation. It's really amazing.
They were really talking. Mm. Like it sounded like speech often.
Yeah,
it was great.
they were counting, but it sounds like
amazing.
They're talking.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
That's people always say, "Oh, what are you thinking about when you're playing music? Like you're counting your brains out."
And imagine you're counting, and yet it sounds like that talking cat in the beginning.
Well, exactly. These instruments can do so many things. They can do an extraordinary, much like the human voice. You know,
exactly.
An extraordinary range of sounds that can be produced, you know, for an inventive composer to think of.
I intend to hear that again.
Yeah. Great. It's going out on the podcast. And
that's great.
I'll send you the video when it's done. Yeah.
Wow.
Very nice. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, one of the things that you talk about in The Power of Babel, too, that I found really inspiring is there's no wrong way to speak, right? I mean, and can you expand on that? Because that's really, because, you know, I remember watching some British movie and the snobby character is like, we will speak the Queen's English, you know? I mean, insinuating that the other person wasn't as well educated or that the person's English was not proper English. And you talk quite a lot about that in The Power of Babel. So can you expand on that idea? There is no wrong way to speak.
Yeah. What I meant by that in that book is that in the scientific sense, there is no such thing as ordinary, fluent, casual speech that's somehow broken, that's somehow less sophisticated than, say, a Winston Churchill speech or, you know, the way they write in the Wall Street Journal or something like that. Naturally, we assign badges of formality to certain flavors, but all of that is completely arbitrary. And even in, you know, the baggiest speech, you can find complexities that you wouldn't know. Figuring out how like in its newish way works is, you know, absolutely fascinating. Figuring out what even means. So he even had a horse. Imagine telling somebody new to the language what even means in that sentence. It's actually, it's very subtle. It can be kind of quantified, but all speech has that. So it just means that naturally we're going to like hearing some people more than others. Some people happen to be more articulate than others. But if we're talking about the speech itself in its ordinary form, there's no such thing as broken speech, or at least I'm not aware of any linguist or anthropologist finding, for example, that one of the things a group doesn't do very well is talk. There's no such thing. Some human groups have better cuisine. Some human groups have better dance. All of that is true. Not language. There's no such thing as a group with a lesser language that they just have to make do with. It just never happens.
Is ain't a word?
It is. And it started with amant. Notice you never say amant. It's because it went amant, and ain't. And so that's where ain't came from. And if English were never written down, and it were just allowed to do what it wanted to do, ain't would have taken over and eaten up aren't a long, long time ago. And you can see the evolution. It's relatively recent. A book that people rarely read these days, and I don't recommend it, but somebody kind of forced me to, is Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's a very important book, but it's 513 pages long. And
could have been 510.
It really, frankly. And so it went on and on. But it's actually, it was a pretty good book. But in that one, they're still saying ant. It isn't ain't yet. Mm. It had started the century before. So yeah, ain't is a word, but we read it as informal. And so we think of it as something that you don't use in certain contexts. But that's purely accidental.
Is it similar? I mean, you know, when a cell divides, there are mutations. I mean, as people use words, there are mutations. There are, you know, people mispronounce the word, they say it a different way, they have an accent, et cetera, and that becomes the new word in a way, right?
All sorts of things like that happen. Or, here's one. I am a truck driver. Amand I? Because you are a truck driver, aren't you? I'm a truck driver. Amand I? Well, it shouldn't be aren't I. And it isn't. People started saying amand, ant, aunt. But if you're British, you think aunt has an R in it. And so people started writing it that way. Then they started pronouncing it that way. Wow. That's why you say aren't I. Mm-hmm. Language is a magnificent mess. It's English is a magnificent bastard tongue. That's another one of my children.
Yeah, no, I know that book. Yeah.
So that's how these things happen, often by accident that then gets caught in stone. Caught in stone. Etched in stone.
I like caught in stone. And then if enough of us use it, that becomes the new phrase soon, and nobody knows where it came from.
Why do we say caught in stone? Because that guy one night. But yeah, it gets etched in stone.
I mean, when you hear people talk, I mean, every word has traces of other words, of histories, of past. You know, you can get lost in it. I mean, in a way, how do you even focus in a conversation?
Frankly, it means that you're never bored. Mm. You know, if you know your phone runs out or something, you can listen to the person next to you, and you can just think, okay, why that word? Why this word? Are people really saying that these days? And every word has a story. If I'm stuck for a topic for my podcast, Lexicon Valley, by the way, then you know the cheap thing to do is I just pick some word. And the idea is, well, this week we're going to do a Fantasia on the word. The last one I did was business. And I just talk about the word business for 20 minutes. There's always stuff. And by the time you've said all the stuff, you've got a podcast episode. So yeah, that's the thing about language, that every word has a tale. Except for lox. Lox has meant salmon for 2,000 years. It's a very boring word.
Is that a Norse word? Where does that come from?
It's a Slavic word.
Slavic, actually. Okay.
And that's just, it just sits there. But that's only lox.
What about polis, you know, taxi? These words haven't changed much.
They don't change much in our lifetimes.
Okay.
But with lox, it's like 2,000 years.
Yeah,
come on.
That's a long time.
Move to tuna or something. But it's always the same thing.
Herring, something.
So we finally got around to making delis. Lox was already there. It was there for us. It was just waiting
Literally.
For us to make a deli.
Just sitting there. Yeah,
that's great. We're going to move towards my piece, which is called Semantics. And I was very interested in how we graft meaning onto sound. I think that's a really interesting thing. I mean, ma doesn't mean. It doesn't have to mean anything, but it becomes, you know, we humans do, we graft meaning onto these, I think at first, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, John, but very simple syllables, and then we start adding more syllables. And
it would have begun that way, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's fascinating. It's very similar in music. Any composer can tell you, you know, when you have a piece of yours played, when you talk to people afterwards, you get, because everybody brings their own baggage in, so you get a bunch of different, you know, interpretations. And I've had people for the same piece say, oh my God, that piece was so heavy. And then someone else is like, it was so light, I was going to float away. And both are right. It's like, okay, great. I'm glad, you know, it's really cool. So with semantics, with this piece, I started with a pitch set. I just created some, I didn't create the pitches. That's pretty grandiose, isn't it? I created some pitches. I chose some pitches.
And you
hear them in a variety of different idioms, speaking of idioms, and it's kind of up to you to graft meaning onto them. It opens up with just a D in the guitar, and it goes from there, and it changes tempo. It does a lot of different things. If it sounds like bluegrass to you, it may not to me. I didn't mean it that way, but it's called semantics, and you can put whatever meaning onto it you like.
Thank you.
We're going to have a little bit. The last piece is just for solo cello and electronics. So we are going to bid farewell to our guitarist and violinist. Can we get a big hand, please, for Jay Source on electric guitar, Suleiman Takali on violin. And there will be some foo-farah going on over here as we get ready for the next piece. Just ignore all of that and listen to us instead.
That's great.
That tasted like Old Bay seasoning.
Okay, all right.
If it had a taste.
John, I just, you know, I need you to just provide quotes for,
that's just,
for us.
Put that out there.
Great. I love it.
It was neat.
It's great. That combination of electric guitar and strings is something I'm just not that familiar with. I'm sure that there are many pieces that have been... That use those components.
Not so much.
It's really
necessarily
sonically satisfying.
Yeah,
very dense.
Absolutely,
there's something really beautiful about the way they're playing with each other.
Yeah, there were a lot of emails going around between Noah, Rosie, Will, and I about what we wanted to write for, and that was what we settled on. You know, so
it's
and,
great.
Extremely happy.
There's
with
a warmth
it.
In it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I like that. Yeah. And not just in the middle. There's a queer kind of warmth in the beginning and the end too. It's neat.
Yeah, definitely. There's so many ways you can go with it. I mean, you know, same with language. I mean, language can go and evolve in so many different ways. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. And, you know, and someone like James Joyce, I mean, can just bend the English language, you know, in a way where you're like, okay, I don't even know what you're trying to say, but I love hearing it.
Right.
I mean, it's absolutely beautiful, you know. And
very
I mean,
much.
There aren't so many people that can use the sheer power of language. Speaking of, I mean, do syllables have meaning or not? You know, in Joyce, it doesn't have meaning, but when you put the meaning onto it, you're pretty much right, maybe, about what he meant.
Right.
He was a fascinating and probably slightly sick man.
Oh, I think he was very sick, actually.
The way he used language, but boy, does it work. But it's always the little things, like at the end of, this is like not pretentious because I can't remember the name of it. The two ruffians who are running around and messing with women and being petty criminals. It's the beginning of Dubliners.
Yeah.
I forget what it's called. And the final line in it is, give us a hand. And he's just saying it to one other person. Well, why us? You know, why give us? And it's a polite term. Instead of saying, give me a hand, you say, give us, because it implies that it's plural. It's the same thing as tu and usted in Spanish. We don't think of English as having it. But you find a lot of that in Joyce, actually, these subtle little things that these often very humble people who don't think of themselves as wordsmiths are saying. Yeah, yeah, it's fascinating.
Let's transition to a piece that has, I think, nothing to do. Well, it has to do with anxiety about language, actually. So the piece is by David Crowell, and it's going to be performed by Eva Cassian-Lakosh, and you're both going to talk about it a little bit, right? Great.
Please.
Well, speaking of Slavic languages, this one's in Croatian.
That is one difficult
language. I know, and that's kind of what we're going to talk about. I am half Mexican, half Croatian, grew up in Ohio, and very interesting place. But I have spent every summer in Croatia. I have an ensemble there. I'm very immersed in many ways, except linguistically. I've just never had a grasp on the language. It is one of my first languages. I did speak Spanish and Croatian when I was very little, and they kind of disappeared. And I really struggle with the language every time I'm in Croatia, and it's very much connected to my identity as well. Like, I'm not Croatian enough, I'm not Mexican enough, because I'm not fluent in the languages. So that's a little bit of the background. I don't know if you want to jump in.
Sure. I mean, this piece didn't exactly start as a piece about language. As a piece of about a trip to Zadar, which is on the Dalmatian coast of Croatia, and a particularly interesting musical instrument there called the sea organ, which essentially is an organ built into the side of some marble stairs which plays the sea. And it's this really fascinating 24-hour instrument there. So we had this great experience being there.
Do you mean a note sea or the ocean?
Sea, like the body of water.
Yeah.
It plays
Adriatic Sea.
The water.
Yeah.
You can't say water in the Balkans. You have to say sea.
It's the sea. It is not an ocean. Yeah. It is not the water. It is the sea. The sea.
I've been made. This has been.
You offend Croatians if you call the sea water that you drink.
Yeah.
Learn something every day.
Yeah. So that's how it started. But then as we got into it, we started thinking about words in Croatian, and what actually ended up happening was that Eva's mother wrote the text for it. But there's a kind of dichotomy in the piece in terms of the language, which I think you'll hear, which is that there are some there's many samples of Eva both singing and speaking. The speaking samples are basically cut up in a kind of stuttering way using a technique called granular synthesis, which is, we won't go into the specifics of that, but so this is, I think, not exactly intentionally, but what became clear very soon was that this captured kind of this vulnerable part of Eva's relationship to the language, and I think you can hear that. And that's put against this beautiful solo part, which Eva sings, which are the words of her mother, in which she sings very fluently and with a pretty much a perfect Croatian accent. To me, I see Eva as a fluent communicator because she really is having conversations in Croatian, but I know that she feels slightly differently about that. So this piece is kind of exploring those ideas.
Bona.
Italia, Italia. Thank you.
That was beautiful. Thank you. What an interesting musical journey we've been on tonight. You know, Todd and I like to tackle big themes. Linguistics is a big theme. All the themes are big. And every time we do one, like, oh, we're going to go off and tackle another big theme. And it's like, we barely got to the, tackle. We scratched the surface. I know, tackle. We barely scratched the surface of linguistics. And there's so much more music out there that relates to language. And I mean, you know, the links between the two of them are just so fascinating to me. There's so many different ways that we could go. So we're going to do this again tomorrow night, a completely different show. No, I'm kidding. You're free, right?
I'll be right here. Leaving.
until we exhaust the topic. we'll just keep going.
Keep tackling. Yeah.
Well, we are pretty much at the limit. Can I get another big hand for all the composers, please? And for our wonderful band. Oh, my goodness.
Amazing.
Thank you. And I want to thank Sopus Foundation, LTD, and Todd Lippe. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Seth.
And a huge thank to our special guest, John McWhorter. Thank you, John. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Go out and get pronoun trouble. I keep trying to say proton trouble for some reason, which is very different.
I'll do that later. Yeah,
yeah, get on to protons later.
I need a change.
They're pretty interesting, too, or
they
so I've heard.
They're the opposite of something. Yeah.
Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. For Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thanks so much for listening.